The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or to view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
I don't know, I thought about telling you a little bit of how I got into this stuff. I grew up on Cape Cod and Falmouth, and I had really no exposure to jazz at all when I was a kid, other than the Stray stuff that I heard here and there. But I did have a high school band director who was a Maynard Ferguson nut, and I don't think he really liked jazz that much at all. I think he just liked high note trumpet playing, you know? So he would have us attempt to play these Maynard charts, which were way out of the range of most high school trumpet players, you know. But I remember listening to those records, and I played piano, and I also played drums. So I would learn the drum parts, the piano parts, those things, read the charts. And I remember, I guess it was a fortuitous accident, I had he got a hold of the Maynard chart on Chameleon, and I saw that it was composed by this guy, Herbie Hancock, and I didn't know who Herbie Hancock was. But I noticed as I flipped through the record bins, you know, record store, jazz bands, that there was a Herbie Hancock section, you know, so I thought, well, it must be, maybe it's the same guy, and maybe it's, you know, maybe I should check this out, see if there's a Herbie recording of Chameleon, you know. So I assume most of you, and most people here have heard that record one way or another, yeah. And Headhunters, yeah, but I didn't know anything about Headhunters. It's probably 75 or 6 or whatever. And so I brought the Headhunters home, and it was like a revelation from on high for me. And so that was how I got into jazz, you know. And probably within a year or two of that, I remember getting a hold of some articles and books on Herbie. And I remember reading this thing where he said the way that he learned to play jazz was by transcribing. And that, he thought it was important to write down solos and learn to play. So I remember, again, you know, I had no clue. I did my high school library. I didn't know how to guide me or anything like that. And I just remember thinking to myself, well, you know, if this is how he learns, I guess this is what I need to do. I need to get a hold of some solos. And then I figured, well, I'll start with some Herbie solos, which wasn't the easiest thing to do. But anyway, make a long story lousy, over the years, I became, you know, that was how I learned how to transcribe. I was classically trained, but I didn't really have any jazz lessons. There wasn't really anybody around that, you know, was teaching that stuff. So in the course of, I guess, my development, you know, learning about other, you know, as we all do with jazz, you know, you learn who played with who and go listen to that guy and who did that guy listen to and go listen to that guy. So coming across, you know, Miles and then the Miles and Gill things. And I guess somewhere in there, I always had a taste for, even way back from those Maynard Ferguson charts, had the taste for orchestration and instrumental combinations and stuff like that. And when I heard the Gil Evans things, like a lot of people, I was just like, what is this stuff? And how do you get that sound? You know, what is he doing there? You know, so that was kind of the beginnings of me. You know, by the time I seriously engaged the Gil stuff, I was pretty well into college. Started trying to pick away voicings, and you know, you just quickly find I'm not sure what instrument that is, and I don't know if I can hear that or not. So I remember reading this thing where Bill Dobbins talked about, for him, Clare Fisher was like this benchmark, you know, that he would try to transcribe Clare Fisher charts. And he said, you know, every year or so I'd pull out a couple that I liked and try to pick them off, and I thought, okay, I'm not ready yet. I got to go transcribe some other stuff first, you know. Then you'd come back a year later. So I guess the Gil things were something like that for me, in the sense that the first two or three that I did was probably over 4 or 5 years, and sometimes, you know, you come back a year later and you've transcribed other things, you've played more gigs, you've done other stuff and trained your ears more, and you know, how could I not have heard that? You know what I mean? So that was also like a natural part of the process, you know, that just sort of revising things as I went along. So I did that through, I guess, you know, that took me up through the you know, mid to late 80s or so when I was in graduate school. I had a teacher who was really into Gill, and I studied at the University of Miami with Ron Miller, who was really into modal stuff. Marcus mentioned a lot of modal stuff. Ron's books are unbelievable. To me, that if you're into the Herbie, Ron, and Tony Wayne group, Ronnie's explanations of that stuff are like the most coherent and logical explanations of that music that I've ever seen or heard, to the point where I think everything else is just blind attempts at trying to explain what's going on in that music. But Ronnie, one of the things that I started talking to him about transcribing Herbie, and he said, man, you got to go get Reville's False Note with Sentimental and play that, you know, and you'll hear those Herbie voices, you know. And so I went to the music library and signed up False Note with Sentimental and spent the next hour picking away at like the first five bars of that, and every time I finally got a voice, wow, that sounds like Herbie. Wow, that sounds like Herbie, you know. And you start hearing all this stuff. So that was, you know, some of my development, too. With the Gill things, you know, I guess it was just initially I wanted to play some of the ballads as solo piano things. So it was figuring out most of what was there, and then how could you crunch it down to fit it under two hands and still get the essence of the chart and the counter lines and that kind of thing. And of course, for me anyway, I think for most people who are into Gill, the counterpoint is a big, big thing. You know, when I look back at the people that I really liked, whether it's Herbie or Claire Fisher or Gill, or hearing Alan Broadbent on the West Coast, you know, all those players later on, Jim McNeil and Maria Schneider, you know, they all have all this counter stuff going on, all this counterpoint going on, even some Oliver Nelson stuff that I remember listening to, you know. And Duke Ellington, of course, when I got into Kendrick, and, you know, they all have that thing where they go beyond, Mark was telling me some of the stuff he studied, they go beyond that basic, you know, four-part block harmonization thing, and at least some of them, they're still dealing with block harmonization, but there's lines within that that are moving. You know, others have more overt counter lines that move at different rhythms and stuff like that in true counterpoint. But I guess part of what interested me in Gill's music was not only the sound combination, but also that counterpoint type of thing, too. That was a big thing. I don't know if I consciously thought of that at first. It's just, you know, like a lot of us probably, wow, that sounds cool, like I want to figure that out. And then later on, you kind of come to the reason why you thought of this, you know. So anyway, in the last, you know, 15 years or so, I started transcribing more and more of these things. And as I did my doctoral work at NYU, came toward doing, I was studying with Jim McNeely and came toward doing my dissertation. And everybody was writing 12-tone pieces for orchestra and analyzing them, and I kind of thought, you know, I'm not sure the world needs another 12-tone piece or my analysis of how I compose, you know, so I wanted to do something that I thought would be, you know, a contribution that other people could learn from and that, you know, would be something of value beyond just me getting a degree, you know. And I actually had to jump through a few hoops, but the book was my doctoral dissertation. That's why the thing is so thorough and methodical and stuff. And I was very, very fortunate that I met Hans Gruber at an IAJE conference, and Ronnie Miller, my former teacher, had books published with him, and Jim McNeely did. Ronnie said, well, show him your manuscript, you know. I was hearing all these stories of guys trying to get books published, and it takes years and years and years, and you never hear back from publisher submissions and stuff, and I said to Ronnie, I said, the book's not even done, I only got the first couple of chapters. I said, show it to him anyway, maybe he can tell you what, you know, what you need to do to make it a little more commercial when you're done, you know. And I'm still not getting it. I said, well, man, I've kind of been thinking about that already. I think I'm good with that. You know, just go see him anyway, you know. So I went to see him, and he made an appointment with me, and we finally sat down like a day later. And he looked at it for about 10 minutes and didn't say anything. And finally he looks up and says, I'd like to publish this. And I said, it's not even done, man. It's not even halfway done, you know. He says, well, here's my email, here's my address. You know, let me know when you finished it. I've always wanted to do a book in Gill Evans. And so I went through none of the, I'm blessed to not have gone through any of the baloney that everybody told me you would go through to get a book published, and then I'm sure I would again, because since then Hans has passed away, and that company is not really, you know, he was a musician's guy and really wanted to, you know, he spent money on copyright permissions and stuff like that. That was a thing, and I know that people who've taken over kind of have backed off of that. Don't really want to sink that kind of money into a book, you know. So I don't know where you'd go, but I was fortunate to get that published. And when I published it, I had put so much time in that I didn't want to edit out all that stuff that I did for the methodology, go back through and say what can go, you know. So he published it as it was, which I was glad for. So in the course of doing my research, I happened to... trying to think of how it even came about now. I guess I used to go down to King Brand and buy score paper, and mentioned to one of the guys there that I transcribed Gil's stuff, and they were doing a concert for Bill Russo's Chicago Jazz Orchestra. They were doing Sketches of Spain. And so he said, "You got, you know, any Sketches of Spain stuff?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, we need it by, you know, 3 weeks from now. Can you do one?" And I showed him some of my other stuff, so he had me do Will of the Wisp. I did it for them. And then in the course of that, King Brand, they had to contact with Anita Evans, who was Gil's second wife, his widow. And so they put me in touch with her, and so when I went to do the dissertation, I went and met with her, and they supplied me with a couple of sketches that I have in the book, the Will of the Wisp sketch, and actually one for my ship, and another one for Bess, who was my woman, which I can't remember if I put that sketch in the book or not, but I know I put the Will-O-Wisp one in there. But, you know, some of them, if you looked at the book at all and you saw the Will-O-Wisp sketch, it's really skeletal. The My Ship one and the Bess one were kind of like a grand staff piano chart with a few instruments marked in, some counter lines. And actually, I guess that gives me a good place to start with My Ship. What surprised me at first was that Gil had written the lyrics of the tune across the top of the grand staff chart. And over the years, I was always the guy who read a lot of stuff. I always thought it was important to, like, find out about musicians' lives and what they did and how they developed and how they lived day to day. And I remember reading this Lester Young thing where he said, you know, when you play a ballad, you should know the lyrics to the tune. You know, you should think about the lyrics while you play. And it always sort of struck me that when you listen to Miles play a ballad, that, you know, he had to know those lyrics because, and I was fortunate too, again, that I had a good teacher in that regard. In grad school, Vince Maggio down in Miami, he was an excellent vocal coach in addition to being a good pianist. And he used to talk to the vocalists about, you know, that when you sing a melody, I'm thinking just of, you know, the meaning of the blues or something, that you don't sing the meaning of the blues. He would say, you know, you emphasize meaning or you emphasize blues, but you don't emphasize of. And when that goes to an instrumentalist, if you're a tenor player or a trumpet player playing a ballad, you think of those lyrics and you don't play do 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 because you're emphasizing the word of. And if anybody's singing along with you, you're distorting the meaning of the lyric, you know. So that was always, between the Lester Young thing and what Vince had told me, that was always in the back of my head. And so by the time I saw the sketch for My Ship and I saw the lyrics at the top of the page, I thought, man, you know, this is it right here. You know, this is, you know, what Miles is doing when he's playing a ballad. He's got this in his head, and that's why it always sounds so sweet when he plays these things. And so logical, even when he takes off and does something that isn't part of the original tune, it's still this thing where it just makes perfect sense, you know. And I guess the other thing that along those lines, I guess for me, I'm a big believer in, you know, I guess believing in what you're doing. There's a great interview with Bill Withers, of all people, on a Marcus Miller CD. And Bill Withers says, the way that I judge a tune is whether I wish I wrote it or not. And I think, you know, that was for me, this stuff was like, man, I wish I thought of that. I wish I was the one who did that, you know. Even though you can't be, it's, you know, you're that passionate about it, and this is part of, I think, even those guys playing it, you know, when they played it, they've got that, you know, they're making that tune their own thing, you know. And in that sense, they, when they pick the tunes, and you read about how they pick the tunes for Miles Ahead or whatever, as you'll find out later, some of these tunes were dog tunes to begin with, but they saw something in that tune or heard something in that tune that nobody else heard, and they were able to make that tune their own in a way that even the original composer didn't necessarily hear, you know. And I think that's one of the key things with Gil's writing and Miles' playing, is that they were able to see or hear something in this music that transcended the original form or structure of the music, you know, some expressive level that hadn't been brought out. So anyway, when we get to my ship, I got a few copies, so you're going to look on with each other, right? So we can pass a couple back anyway, you can share. These are concert key scores. So
I think we have a couple more so we don't know what I want. Here we go. I've got that part of my head. Do you want to see?
One of the things that I did, this was actually about the third one that I had ever transcribed. And back in the 80s, they had reissued this CD, but some of the takes were in stereo, some were in mono, so they had reissued it in stereo and hadn't used some of the original takes. Tio Macero had spliced together all new stuff. And then later on, George Avakian put out another version that was all in mono, saying, well, we can't find the stereo master for the original, but these are the original takes, you know. And so then I heard it sounded like, you know, there was one bass clarinet line in the Tio version, and there was a different bass clarinet line in the Avakian version. It wasn't until they were starting to do the box set, put together a lot of the research, and the guy from King Brand was involved in that. He was getting these tapes here and there as they were putting things together, and he showed me some of the session lists of who played what. And you know, I knew that there had been bass clarinet, but actually three of the woodwind players at various times play bass clarinet. I think on Miles Ahead, it's actually three bass clarinets going at one time. So on this tune, it's Lee Conn's played alto. He played alto all the time. And then there were three woodwind players that the first chair was like a flute oval clarinet chair, and some pick, I think, also. And the second chair is actually the most work. It's, I think he does flute, alto, flute, oboe, clarinet, and bass clarinet. I'm talking across the whole album now, all 10 tunes. And the third, the last chair, which is the fourth chair here, is all bass clarinet, except when I got a hold of Gil's scores for a couple of the later tunes, apparently only some guys could play alto flute, so he flopped a couple of, you know, having the last guy play alto flute on something so that another guy could play bass clarinet or something like that. It was an instrumentation change somewhere in Meaning of the Blues and Lament, you know. But really, it was only necessary because of the particular people that they had on the session, you know. So there's four woodwinds, Miles in the lead role, two horns, five trumpets on this. The fifth trumpet kind of acts like a renegade. Sometimes he's doubling the first part, sometimes he's cut loose, sometimes he's playing the first part but with a different mute than what the first player has. In the case of my ship, I'll show you that in some pages later on. Then there's four trombones, tuba, string bass, percussion. It's obvious that Miles and Paul Chambers and Art Taylor were the weakest readers on the section by the way they fluff stuff and when there's written parts and stuff like that. They don't always know. On the other hand, especially Paul Chambers, even when he totally blows something, what he plays instead is sometimes even better than what Gil wrote, and you just kind of shake your head and think, man, I don't know how he couldn't read that figure. But on the other hand, what an ear this guy had, you know. Blues for Pablo is like that. I've seen the score for that. And you look at the bass part, there's times when there's little octave things going from B-flat to F to a high B-flat, and he's actually playing the wrong B-flat both times. He's obviously trying to fake the line. But what he fakes is actually even better than what Gil had written in there, you know. So they were good like that, you know. So anyway, actually, if you look at the intro, you can see in this case it's second trumpet that has harmon mute, and all the others are in cups. And this is an octave unison line, basically two cups on the top octave, two cups on the bottom, and then the harmon is doubling in the top. Again, if I went back 15 years, I'm sitting there thinking, gee, kind of sounds like a harmon, kind of, you know. And I remember also thinking, well, they must have only had four guys playing on this chart because I can only hear four voices, but this is what it is. And I learned that when I saw the Blues for Pablo chart. I haven't seen a score for my ship, but when I saw Blues for Pablo, I saw that originally most of the ensemble passages were muted in cups, and the first part was doubled, sometimes by second, sometimes by fifth, in unison, but with harmon. And when you go back and you listen in the box set, you listen to the very first take of Blues for Pablo, it's all muted. It was obviously like second take that they must have said, hey, let's try these without mutes. But you hear the guy in the harmon still in the harmon along with the open four-part section. So that's what clued me in. That must be why I'm only hearing four voices in my ship and why I can't decide whether that first part is cop or harmon, because it's actually both and you're hearing that blend of the two, you know. So he was really innovative with things like that, Gil was, you know, just orchestrational things, not only using instruments that weren't common in a jazz ensemble at that time, but also instrumental combinations and mutings and woodwind and mute combinations and stuff that really have been very, very subtle, you know. And once once I saw a couple of those things, then I'd start to listen for things along the way and you start noticing, but you sort of train your ear in that sense by, you know, first getting clued into a couple of things and then start to notice, okay, it sounds like this, or this must be a similar thing, similar combination. The intro itself is actually from, the tune is from a Kurt Weill musical called Lady in the Dark. The intro is from the original score. Really what's Gil's in the intro is the pedal tone and the tuba and trombone, and the bass clarinet counter line is his also. And I think in some ways it really kind of makes the intro to hear that counterpoint climbing up on the bass clarinet, especially you put some bass clarinet, sometimes the bass clarinet in Gil's music is doubling the bass line and it gets that sinister kind of sound, but other times he's got it in like here, climbing up into an extreme high register, and it takes on almost like a flute-like quality to it, you know? And to me, that was an interesting sound, too, to know that bass clarinet does get softer as it goes up, unlike most instruments, but it also has a real different sound up in that high register than it does down low. I brought the Broadway version for them to check out, and then we can maybe read through the score, and then if you have some questions, to ask those, I guess. I'll tell you what track it is. It's track six. This is I think this recording was from the early 90s. It's a Broadway cast from Lady in the Dark. So you're hearing the tune in its original form as it is in the Broadway score. One of the interesting form things is it's an A, B, A tune, but Gil has three A sections up front. And the first one is the ensemble without any bass. And, you know, sometimes you hear, like as a texture change, you hear ensemble without drums. But to me, the ensemble without the bass takes on this real orchestral kind of quality and really brings out the counterpoint in the bass line here. Bass clarinet and bass trombone and tuba are playing the bass line, and the way, even though they're moving, except for the second bar and the last bar of that section, they're moving the same rhythm as the ensemble. It's a lot of contrary motion, and then the second and eighth bars is a lot of actual counterpoint in the bass line there. And it's really cool how those voicings move, and even the spacing of those voicings is also very interesting. And it's along the lines of a Bill Evans-style rearm where there's a chord under every melody note, you know, rather than the original changes of the tune, you know. Then at the what I labeled B1 in the chart, that's where the more conventional, you know, the original chord changes of the tune are sitting under Miles, and Miles is playing 2A sections with that. And then the bridge, which is letter C, page 5, that's where Gil has like a little double time melody that he's abstracted out of the original theme of the tune. And that, to me, is, you know, classic Gil. I mean, he does this cool stuff with coming up with boppish lines that still imply, if you know, or if you don't know the tune, if you listen on the original recording, listen to the bridge melody, and then try to remember that when you hear his double time figure, it's a cool little bop line that you could envision, you know, Dizzy and Bird playing, and yet it encompasses the melody. You know, same type of thing happens in Best. If you checked out my analysis of Best, there's a couple bars in the middle of the chart there where he's got this double time thing. That's a real boppish line, but the peaks and valleys in the line are the original melody. Now, part of the changes that Gil made, besides the obvious one of the bridge that I pointed out, he used the intro as the ending, comes back to the intro, and I always liked the idea that Miles never comes back to the tonic at the end of that. He just leaves that leading tone hanging, and it's resolved more through the harmonies that Gil plays, you know, in the outro, you know. And the other thing, to me, there's a lot of, in that version, there's a lot of ebb and flow to the tempo, but sometimes, to me, it's over-dramatic, sometimes it misses the point dramatically. I think them playing in steady tempo in Gil's chart, between how Gil rhythmically moves certain chords and how Miles delays certain notes, I think it actually adds more drama to the piece too, so it might be something also to listen for as you listen to the chart. In this version, I've cut Miles' exact playing transcribed, but there, I also do a version of when I did a concert at CCRI. And in that case, I just gave the trumpet player the original quarter note, my ship melody with the lyrics under it, you know, when I gave Miles Price to study, but for the concert I had him just read off of a straight version of it and improvise his own thing. So you want to go ahead and play that?
Number 4, right?
Yeah, track 4.
That's it.
It's really kind of 2-5 tuned suite, so they're all segregated. So there's no real resolution chord. It's a D flat chord at the end, so I don't saw it, it sets up Miles' head, which is in C, so it becomes like a sub 5 chord.
Can I just make a couple of short comments? Because we've done a little bit with counterwise, but we need to do a lot more. But this is a great, obviously, that bass clarinet.
Yeah.
Okay, but if we could look at page D, whatever that is, or whatever D is, page 6 and 7, and maybe you can say more about this. But if you look at this,
so the horn comes in and has that climbing thing there.
The trombones are doing one little idea. They're all together, but then the first trombone in the third bar moves a little bit independently.
Right.
Then the horn comes in, then the clarinet comes in. Meanwhile, the trombones are, so you're building this thicker texture.
Absolutely.
But everything fits. Everything is like perfect.
Yeah.
And then you get on the next page 7. And the clarinet, bass clarinet, they're starting out, and the trombones join it, which is a really nice effect. Given more.
Yeah, well, it is a great effect, and it, actually some of those things, like if you look at how he does it, you know, the trombones back at D start with a, you know, a fairly stock voicing kind of thing, nothing that would really, it sounds good, but nothing that would blow you away from a theory point of view. And then, like Mark said, all of a sudden the first bone is moving. There's places in there where second or third trombones moving in chord notes and somebody else is holding half notes, so there's these shifting lines against, you know, some kind of, at least part of a chord, you know. In the meantime, the horn's added in, the clarinet's added in. The way that those are added in is almost like you notice it after the fact rather than them, you know, I know when I first transcribed it, I'm like, wait a minute, it sounded like just trombones. Now I'm hearing four voices, and that can't be the bass trombone coming in, and it can't be everybody shifting up one note in the voicing, because you lose the sense of all those lines, you know. And then the same thing when you look on page 7, like Mark pointed out, the three clarinets, they start with this very tight voicing. The first two clarinets are a second apart from each other, but that voicing gradually spreads out. And by the time you get toward the end of that, the trombones, if you look at the clarinet voicings, it's really an incomplete voicing. What's happening by the second bar of that is the trombones are carrying the body of the chord, and the clarinets are filling in some color tones that provide interesting melodic content, but that don't form a complete chord by themselves, you know. And so it starts out as a clarinet choir, and then when the bones come in, it becomes this whole combination clarinet and bone thing sort of woven together harmonically, you know. So it's a really cool effect. And that's, to me, the climax of the dramatic climax of the chart is right there. And he just takes everything away except the bass line after that, you know. There is bass clarinet and bass bone on it, but it's just them and the string bass way down with Miles way up. It's like the middle just falls out after that climax and takes it way, way down, you know. So it's the whole thing is a really nice effect, beautiful piece of arrangement.
And this, I just want to emphasize this because I've talked about this is why when we get to Gil Evans, this stuff, this is why we call it the jazz orchestra for real.
Yeah.
This is the real deal. And one other quick question, because this is something that amazed me. Did anybody here, even though you're looking at this, when that opening introduction came, did anybody hear or think they were hearing something else? Some other cat's out of the bag.
Yeah. Once you see the score, you don't know what's.
I was putting this together to put out our solos, and so I was listening to some, and I thought, oh, isn't that nice with those flutes? There's no flutes anywhere.
Yeah.
It's that combination of the mutes and
right.
the trumpets.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely you know the Ellington translucency. Maybe you played that for them. You know there's Duke and Gil seem to have that thing where. Sometimes they put a certain combination of instruments together, and you'd swear that you're hearing another note or another instrument or something like that. I think that's what Mark's driving at. There were definitely times in this where I'm like, you know. And you know what the other one is that's like that? Actually, this is what made me realize that this passage was in Hatnewts. In New Rumba, on the same album, when they play that little figure behind Miles, so... It's kind of got a little variation melodically each time, but it's pretty much the same chords and the same lick. And sometimes he does it harmons and flutes, like in a choir where they're doubling each other. Sometimes he does it with trombones and tuba. And sometimes it sounds like Miles and French horns and bass clarinet. And I sat there for days listening to that thing and thinking, there's only two horns listed on the record. It sounds like there's four horns. This is driving me crazy, you know. And I saw some jazz catalog, and it said, oh, there's this... I knew that they had done the television show in 1959 at Robert Harris Theater. They had played some pieces from Miles Head. And I saw this jazz catalog, and it said they had the video of Gil Evans and Miles Davis from 1959. I thought, oh, you know, they played New Rumba on there. Maybe in the video you can kind of... you know, get a handle on what's going on. They were, and Gil always set up in a horseshoe with the brass were in a big row over here, and the woodwinds and horns over here, and drums and bass are here, and Miles and Gil are up front there, you know. And so you see it in the studio pictures, and you see it it's in the panning, in the record, the woodwinds are hard right, and the brass are hard left, and the rhythm section, and Miles are in the middle. It's a very early stereo kind of thing, you know. And so anyway, in the video, I got the video, I turned it on, and some woodwind stuff that it couldn't see because they're panning around the horseshoe. But darn if I didn't see, there's the trombones with Hatnewts mounted on the stands, and when the French horn thing comes along, two bones just put their instrument down, two other guys lean into the hats and playing with the French horns, and then they back right out, and the four bones are playing the lick together. And I'm thinking, damn, you know this... I spent days trying to figure out what was in that voicing, And it never would have dawned on me if I hadn't seen it on the video. But once I saw it on the video, then you realize, oh, you know, how is he getting this to balance, you know, three bones and one horn? The hapnute is the answer there, you know. A bucket mute will give you like the same sort of effect, except that clips on, and so the problem becomes the logistical thing. If you're going back and forth between open and muted real quick, like in New Rumba, the bucket mute's useless, you know. So it was half mutes, and instead of holding it the way you'd hold a plunger or something like that, he's actually got it clipped onto the stand, and they're leaning into it, you know. I don't know about you, but I always found when I play any kind of big band stuff, if you wrote stuff for half mutes or whatever, the brass players, you'd think that you were asking them to march from here to Los Angeles with 100 pounds on their back, you know. So after a while, you know, I don't carry that, I don't own that. So I bought four half mutes for trombones, and I just bring them to gigs.
So you gave me this, bring them.
Yeah. But it's, I don't know if you found
it. I don't even know. Do you guys even use bucket and hat mutes in
the
FJ?
We used hat mutes.
This is a very bad drawing, as you know. It's with an egg, frying an egg. But it's literally like a derby.
Yeah,
hat.
Yeah.
And it was big in the swing era.
Yes.
And so, for
that reason, it's out of style. It's considered really unhit.
And so wouldn't wear it. It's like you said, you'd have it like here on a stand. So you could, what he's giving you is you can easily just put your horn, trumpet, and trombone towards it, and so it makes it. Sometimes you'll see it written on a score in stand, but you try to get the same effect. Here's the music stand with the paper, so you push the bell up, and it gives a little muffled quasi French horn, which is a really good sort of idea. This is a really good one, but it literally looks like.
It's
an old hat. You know Jackie Kennedy, the hat she used to wear, a pillbox.
Box,
bigger. She would never have worn this. Bigger. And it has these little clips on the side. So that, like you're saying, you have to clip it on.
Yeah.
I don't really own any of these. You know, top, sort of far off. And I know there are bands that have those.
Yeah. When I was younger, the only time I ever saw a hat mute used was, it was like in the Glenn Miller stuff, and it always struck me like they were trying to kind of have a polite version of the Ellington plunger thing, like they, because people would use it for the wah-wah sound, but it wasn't nearly as nasty as the Ellington, the growl and plunger thing, you know, where you really get that dirty sound, you know. And with the hats, using them that way, it was like a very polite society kind of thing. So I knew why brass players didn't want to carry that mute, because it was considered, you know, you don't want it to sound like that. That's gone. That's out.
Actually,
you know.
Actually, if you're really interested in this, which I don't know why you do, there's a guy named Morris Welk.
Oh,
Morris Welk has since gone out of his reward. They still show his band, tape things on the channel, I think it's like New Hampshire Public Television, which I can't hardly get. And there they are, and they got their little band. It's totally polite. And the thing about the Welk band, I'll then shut up, is that he would allow his people to improvise, although he was very frank with improvisation. And this is what I heard, was that if you were going to improvise, you had to submit the improvised solo written out ahead of time so they could approve it. Well, that's not exactly the problem.
Yeah. We could have one or two more conversations.
But you'll see these views.
What the hats do is basically quiet the trombone down so it can balance under the French horns. You know.
How do they hold the
hat's mounted on the stand, and so they're leaning into the hat with the
rest of the instrument goes past the horn.
Yeah, so they're basically at the stand off to the side. Yeah, yeah. I know what I did was I wound up taking, like, you can buy at like Home Depot the pipe clamp stuff, you know. You can use that stuff because you can shape it and you can put a bolt in it, you know. And another thing that I did actually that worked pretty much just as well was taking, like, just take a coat hanger and make it so you can wrap it around the body of the hat, and then you clip that with a couple of real strong, you know, again, like at Home Depot, you can get a couple of strong clamps, you know, clamp that, you know, little clamps, the squeeze clamps that you can clamp that onto the stand, and then you just lay the hat in there, and so they just got to read on the side, and they pick which side they're going to read on, you know. Usually the time we did the Miles Ahead concert, everybody quickly finds out, like, okay, we all need to read off the same side, because my hat's on the right side, yours is on the left, and there's not enough room, you know, so... this logistical things like that, but know, you can do it, and guys get used to it, you know. The guys who played, when I did the Miles Ahead concert, it was, I guess, 3 years ago, we had Jeff Galindo played lead on it. But then there were some other, I'm trying to think of who else was in there, some South Shore guys played on it. But I remember a couple of them just looking at the charts, and one of them looks at me and he says, "Teach me, baby, just teach me," you know. Because there's so much stuff that you learn from this, even just in how to play them, you know, that you, it would just never occur to you as a player, you know. But then when you even just see in one tune, you start realizing how much thought and planning went into this, you know. So yeah, there's all those voicing things that Mark mentioned with the half mutes. Basically, what you do with the half mutes is you gain four French horns. You know, you can orchestrate for what amounts to six French horns, at least that kind of sound. And when you put the tuba with that, you know, you can have this real soft mid and low brass section that's real dense. You know, plus if you want the classic big band brass section, you still got the open bones with the open trumpets that you can, you know, hit. Yeah. So there's I think that's the other thing is with Gil's stuff, you know, you move away from just the brass sax kind of thing. It is, like Mark said, more like an orchestra where you really have all kinds of combinations that some of them may be close to each other, but just this real subtle kind of thing where you can shift colors and stuff like that. And yet it's still within a fairly limited instrumentation in terms of the total number of people that you've got going at. Anybody have any questions at all?
Was it relatively common for there to only be one sax in these
things? No, well, in Gil's thing, but I think part of that was, part of it I think was a combination, there's a funny sort of history where they had, Lee Konitz and Gil had worked in the Clark Thornhill Orchestra, that group had French horns and tuba and some clarinet work and stuff, and then of course out of that came the birth of the cool stuff, which was Lee and Gil and Miles, and there was actually like some Miles had an interest in the Claude Thornhill thing, and Gil had an interest in Charlie Parker's music. There's a couple of Claude Thornhill charts. I got them on there, but we probably don't have time to get into that stuff. The Yardbird Suite in Anthropology, and according to Gil, Gil approached Miles and said, you know, Miles said, you know, he was interested in Claude Thornhill's thing, so he gave Miles, I forget the score to what Claude Thornhill chart, and Miles gave the lead sheet to Donna Lee, and Gil eventually did an arrangement with Donna Lee for the Thornhill Orchestra. And out of that, when the big band era kind of crashed and the bands weren't working, the Thornhill band wasn't working, that's when the discussions for Birth of the Cool started. The Birth of the Cool thing, I mean, if you could put it into one sentence, was what's the smallest band you could have that would still get the Thornhill sound, you know? Then when Miles was signed to Columbia, he was still signed to Prestige at the time, right? And so Columbia was looking for something that was going to make him different and make his Columbia recordings different than the Prestige small group ones. And by that time, in the 50s, you had Nat Cole was recording with Nelson Riddle, and so was Sinatra recording with Gordon Jenkins and Nelson Riddle. And there was this thing where you take a soloist and kind of wrap him in an orchestra. So it was Avakian, George Avakian, that had the idea, you know, what about doing an instrumental version of that, you know, have Miles wrapped in an orchestra, and then it became, well, who do you want to write for you? And that's where Gil came in. And Avakian said, well, I want you to take Birth of the Cool and blow that out to like a bigger instrumentation. But of course, Birth of the Cool was just still in the Thornhill sound, so it was a funny sort of thing, making it smaller and then making it bigger again. And I think, to make a long story lousy, the Lee Konitz thing was that, you know, you had a sort of lead alto that could function as a lead alto in a section, but you had, you know, there's times when that alto is down in the section, there'd be a couple of clarinets and alto and bass clarinet functioning as like a four-piece clarinet section. Because the alto in the Duke, this harmony is like that, where the alto is the third voice in the stack, and it basically sounds like a clarinet choir. You know, there's other times where he acts more like a lead alto. There's also in the Duke in other places, three-part harmony with Miles and Lee and Frank Rehack on the lead trombone, and there's like a three-horn trio there, three-part harmony thing going on. So that. Lead alto, he always, the scores I've seen, he always put it as the top, the way he would in the big band thing. But it doesn't always literally function as the lead voice. Sometimes it's functioning as a third voice or something.
Especially when Miles is playing.
Right, right. Well, it may lead the counter lines when Miles is playing, but it may also be buried in a step, too, you know. So it really kind of depends what sort of sound you're going for. If you're looking for clarinet choir sound, then the alto is going to be buried in that stack, probably. Or if it's only three voices, then like here in page 7 of my ship, it's not even getting used. But if you had four-part harmony, then maybe alto would be in that stack somewhere, you know. But basically hidden as if he's another clarinet, you know. So those are things that, you know, it seems like Gil would be really good at that, too, you know. There's never like a real traditional sax section sound. The closest he comes is having like a clarinet choir. But again, I think it's kind of like between the mutings and the clarinets, and then also the same, you know, two flutes and bass clarinet kind of sound like a flute choir too, you know. So you can wind up with a lot of different sounds in there, even though you don't have the traditional big band sax section to work with. So. Any other questions on that one at all? All right. Yeah, so then...
Steve, just so you know, we've got about 20 minutes.
Okay, all right. Yeah, what I brought... maybe I'll skip Maisie to these then, even though that's an interesting thing. I brought I Don't Want to Be Kissed, and I thought, you know, maybe we could take a quick look at that and then maybe finish with a couple of gongs. And if you have questions along the way, just ask, you know, so that way I'm not just talking the whole time. Maybe what we can do is play him. You want to just play him parts of the two versions, and then play him the whole Miles and Gil version, and then go over to Abbott so they can kind of hear the evolution of it. So yeah, it's basically an orchestrated version of the Miles thing, and what is really interesting on this, I've only seen this couple of pages that have survived of Gil's sketch of this tune, and he literally wrote out four bars of Ahmad's solo and then gave Miles changes and then four bars of Ahmad's solo, and when you listen to the recording, Miles kind of plays like his version of Ahmad's licks and then four bars of what he wants and comes back to it. And the recording process on these things, sometimes Miles had trouble in the original session, so he laid out for certain parts. In this master tape, he actually played the Ahmad licks at the original session and then did the four-bar things on the overdubs in like 3 months later. So it's kind of like him trading fours with himself. You know, it's a neat little thing, you know? So there's cool stuff in there. And then the way he's got the whole ensemble orchestrated, take the piano parts and orchestrated, it's really cool. And the other thing, if you know Miles Ahead, there's a quote from the Barrick Violin Concerto that starts the meaning of the blues. It's got the, it's like a 12-tone thing that comes out of... that kind of thing. And that starts it, and at the end of I Don't Want to Be Kissed, I forget the lick, but it comes to the five, the Ernie Royals on the lead, and he comes down the pyramid, the same 12-tone pyramid at the end of the... And then it goes off to the one chord, you know, with the sharp bell. Yeah, so it's really, but it's from the Barrick Violin Concerto. And he uses it like on that as an intro to the eighth tune, the way Barrick used it, and then he does the whole Barrick thing upside down at the end of this chart, which Ahmad didn't do. That's Gil's insertion.
Can we go for it?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. That's pretty cool. Anybody have any questions on that one? That's a New Rumba's also, the track New Rumba's basically an Ahmad trio thing that's orchestrated out for the full band like that, with some of Gil's stuff put in there. You know, what was always amazing to me, and I don't have time to play Maisie to these for you, but he was really good I guess there's that Stravinsky saying where he says, good composers borrow, great composers steal, you know. And he always seemed to have a knack for putting the most unusual things together, but they really fit together really well. You had a question or? Do I have time to do the cons? Because we had talked about doing those. If I get time, I'll gladly do this.
Real quick.
This one's from Borg and Bess, and actually the this is the Gershwin one arranged, basically. For, I got four copies. I don't know if you made any more.
Is this gone or gone, not gone?
Gone. Is this one. They kind of, we can pass them both out because I think, you know, just go right once a variation on the other kind of. So, anyway, Gone is the Gershwin thing from Porgy and Bess. It's actually in the opera, it's called Where's the Bread of Robins. And it's basically like a preacher and congregation kind of thing. It has like a real gospel kind of thing to it in terms of the call and response thing. And in the original, it's a lead singer and a chorus answering, you know, where's Brother Robbins? And then everybody's singing, he is gone. And it's set up like a preacher congregation thing. Gil's arrangement of it is pretty straightforward from the original. It's just that he's got Miles in the preacher role and then the orchestra's in the congregation kind of role. You know, I did bring, I don't know if you, time-wise, you can decide whether we should listen to the Porgy and Bess version or you want to just go straight to
I
the...
I think we should just...
All right, okay. On that one, I've got to get a different disc, actually. So this is track 4 on this one. The instrumentation on Porgy Bess is a little different. There's 3 horns instead of 2, and there's a little more variation in the woodwind section where there's, I think, one more alto flute that's available and used a little more often. Sometimes the bass clarinet isn't used as much. And there's only 4 trumpets instead of the 5 that there were in Miles Ahead. So sometimes the 4th trumpet is playing that renegade role, sometimes it's just 4, you know, straight section kind of thing. I'm not quite sure why they made that change, but it seems like Sketches of Spain, they went to, I think it was 3 horns and they only went to 2 trombones. It seems like he was moving away from big band straight ahead instrumentation more into orchestral colors and stuff. All right, so the track 4 is Gone. So that's, you know, it's basically taking the Gershwin thing, turning it into like sort of a pocket, you know, and really only 2 instrumental choirs there. What's at work there more than anything is the rhythm, changing the rhythm of the melody, you know, and then having Philly, like you said, is kind of unusual, but it's obviously set up as a drum feature kind of thing, you know, to feature drums and Miles, you know. I always found it interesting, you know, there was an article in the 60s where Gil talked about... if I ever live long enough, I'll do this stuff. But you know, he said, "Oh, it'd be great to have a version of this band where an orchestra plays Herbie's parts, and you still have Miles and Wayne and Tony and all that." You know? And you know, in a way, I think of Gone. It's an older band, but it's the same type of thing. It's taking like the small group, the Miles small group thing, and basically giving a feature for the small group to work within the large ensemble kind of format. Would have been really interesting to see if the money had been there to have them be a touring band, you know, how much smoker stuff could have or would have done work.
Give Steve a round of applause.